everyone. How lovely to be here. You please pray with me.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. Reading from about Lari Mahasya from a book called Puruna Purusha, Yogi Raj Sri Sham Churn Lahari. It's quite a mouthful. Dr. Ashok Kumar Chatterjee. The noble yogi would constantly dwell on extrasensory realm. A Himalayan serene tranquility would perpetually prevail in him. He disliked futile religious discussions with people who did not practice sadhana, or spiritual practice. Rather, he assigned a greater importance on yama, that is control, niyama, rule, asana, sitting posture, pranayama, prana action, pratyahara, withdrawal of senses, dharana, realization, and dhyana, soul engrossment, and samadhi, trance. These are the esoteric eight steps of action of the scripturally stipulated yoga sadhana, that is the eightfold path by Patanjali, as he talks about it. His direct yogic realization was marvelous. Depending on those yoga-derived realizations, he would impart religious advice and confer interpretations of the spiritual texts. None of his expressions were underlied with emotion. The counsel given to his devotees was his direct yogic realization. Therefore, his advice would create an impression on the minds of men. His descriptions were lifelike. He would ask man to derive direct realization through Kriya and gradually become one with the infinite soul. This is the highest wealth in man's life. Without dhyana, realization, and samadhi, one cannot enter the domain of the spiritual kingdom's subtlest of the subtlest essence of the infinite soul. Without dhyana, realization and samadhi, one cannot enter the domain of spiritual kingdom's subtlest of subtle essence of the infinite soul. This is his fundamental statement. He would say, prana is the origin of all power. By practicing prana sadhana, all sadhanas can be performed. This prana has three states. So prana, as we know, is the life force. As the dog comes in and wagging his tail and looking at us, he's exhibiting prana. He has life force in him. When we are listening to the Hanuman Chalisa before and during meditation, Hanuman represents the fourth chakra here at the heart center. Through breath, he's the son of the wind god, and so he represents the breath that is there. Oftentimes, prana is defined as breath. Pranayama is breath control, but that's not really completely accurate or complete description of it. Prana is the life force that flows into the body that allows us to think, to breathe, to have our being. And without that prana, no life would be possible. It's the active ingredient not only in the body, but in all creation. It's what makes the flowers have the life force to come into bloom, for a fruit to have its fullness when its time comes. This is all a result of prana. Everything in creation has this prana in it. The fact that we have prana in us, and it runs through our body, through our nervous system, is the key to our life. As Jesus said, man does not live by bread alone, or the food that you eat, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. It took a yogi in modern times to really relate what that meant, because what does that mean exactly? Every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. What Yogananda knew through Sri Yukteswar and through the yogic teachings is that we are all endowed with a point here at the base of the skull, the medulla oblongata, a very tiny part of the nervous system that's there, but very powerful and very important. And when you are to look at the, not the physical body, but the subtle astral body, the energy body, you find here that there is a opening through which prana or life force flows in. There are examples in India and in other places in the world that have been scientifically proven. There was a yogi that was buried for over 30 days in the ground. No food, no water, no air. And he was put to the test. And after 30 days, he was dug up. He was in a very deep trance kind of state. But as they aroused him out of that state, he came back into full consciousness again and was able to speak and think and operate just as before. And that there are many proven examples of that. There have been saints. Master talks about a couple of them in the autobiography of a yogi, Teresa Newman in Germany and Giri Bala in India. And both of them had existed for 30, 40 years without eating a single thing. What's interesting is that they weren't thin as rails. They were both rather on the plump side. And yet they ate nothing. Now, Teresa Newman had the small wafer, little tiny wafer, that she would take with communion every day. But other than that, she ate nothing. And she would laugh when she was traveling with others and they needed to stop for a meal. And she said, oh, yes, go ahead. Giri Bala loved to cook for everybody. So she'd get in the kitchen and she'd whip a huge meal and feed everybody. And she loved nothing better. But she didn't eat anything herself. And she was tested. There was a Raj there who was curious about her. Locked her up, essentially, for months at a time. Absolutely knew that she wasn't eating anything at all during that time. No effect at all. Just continued on before. Didn't gain any weight. Didn't lose any weight. Just stayed exactly where she was. Full energy, everything. Now, this would seem like an impossibility until you understand that we don't live by bread alone. We don't live by food alone. Now, most people require food in order to keep us sustained. Some of us eat a little bit more than we need, but nevertheless, if we were to go without food for a prolonged amount of time, we would really be suffering, really suffering. But these realized masters, these saints, were able to access this prana. We all do it. You wouldn't be able to live without it. But so this prana and control of prana is the control of life force. And all yoga, all meditation, all methods that are geared toward realizing God are all toward withdrawing the life force from the body, from the afferent and the efferent nerves, bringing up through the spine and concentrating it in the higher centers. Now, this can be accomplished by a number of different ways. We practice the Kriya method, which focuses directly on the spine and the brain and draws the energy up to the higher centers. When Papa chanted Om Shri Ram, he focused here at the Ajna, and through the chant and through the focus here, it spontaneously drew the life force back up through the spine up to the higher centers. There are some people who practice serving God. They're karma yogis in what they do, but their attention eventually is drawn to here, and they too are drawing the life energy up into the higher centers. So no matter what form of meditation or what form of yoga you practice. The intention is all the same, whether it's consciously known or not. Somebody who's chanting may not realize that they are drawing the life force up until it happens spontaneously to them. So Hanuman represents this heart center here. And you will see depictions of him where he has pulled, they're much like Jesus is with the heart, the crown of thorns around the heart that's pictured here at the heart center. Only Hanuman has pulled his chest apart, and you'll see Sita and Rama there. Now, Hanuman was completely devoted to Rama. Rama represents this Ajna place here, the Christ center or the Krishna center there, or the Rama center. Sita represents the Shakti power at the base of the spine and what's drawn up through the spine and has union with Rama here. And so the reason that he has the story behind him pulling his chest apart was that after all the adventures in the story that they had been through, Sita gives Hanuman this very, very expensive pearl necklace. It's the most expensive pearl necklace. Not only that, but it had been given to her by Shiva. So it's a very, very special thing. And so as all of her gratitude, because without Hanuman, none of them would have survived. So she hands this as a gift to Hanuman. And Hanuman picks it up and he to his ear. He sniffs it. He even bites it and breaks open one of the pearls and looks in it. And with all that, he throws it over his shoulder. And she's shocked. And Sita says, Hanuman, I know you're just a monkey, but you're no ordinary monkey. What are you doing? You're treating this as a very, very valuable gift. And he said, well, I picked it up to listen to see if I could hear Om Shri Ram. I didn't hear any Om Shri Ram in it. He says, I bit it open. Maybe it's written on the inside. It wasn't written on the inside. What use is it to me? I threw it away. And so somebody said, well, Hanuman, do you have Ram in you? And so he takes his fingers and he pulls apart his chest there, and there is seated in his heart Rama and Sita. So that was the story, and you'll see depictions where he has that, and then you'll see Rama and Sita pictured that. One of the most endearing stories I know of Hanuman is that after all their adventures, they go back to Ayodhya, and now Rama and Sita are settling down to their lives as a married couple, and they go back into their bedroom, and Hanuman's just right behind them, you know, and Ram turns around and says, no, Hanuman, this is a place for just Sita and I, and you can't come in here. And he goes, why? And he says, do you see this vermilion mark here at her head, you know? And when a lady in India gets married, they start parting their hair down the center, and they'll put the red mark there. And actually, the husband puts it on the first time, and that's a sign that she's a married lady. And he says, do you see that there? He says, that means that Sita and I have this special relationship, and so this is time for us. You need to stay outside now. So Hanuman just sat outside at the door all night long, and he is very put out by all of this. And he wanted to spend that time with Rama also. So in the morning, Rama came walking out with Sita, and here's Hanuman sitting there, and he's just covered in red of the vermilion. And Rama said, Hanuman, what have you done? You're completely covered. And there's a jar there, and he'd taken this entire jar of kumkum powder that's normally just a dot right here, poured the whole thing over the top of him. And he said, well, if Sita gets to spend that time with you just because she has one little mark of that red there, I've dumped the whole jar over my head and covered myself with it, so maybe I'll get to spend that time with you next time. And Ram hugged him and said, oh, Hanuman, I love you even more than Sita. I love you the best. So he's such wonderful stories, wonderful stories.
What does Hanuman represent? Is it Bhakti?
He's his heart center, which is the breath. He's the son of the wind god. So he is pranayama. He is the breath control and the life force control. And also the heart center is the center of the astral body, where life force is distributed throughout the body there at the heart center. So he represents devotion, because he's completely focused on Ram, and which is here, and the aspiration to serve Ram in whatever way he can. He also represents breath control and pranayama, so it's everything to do with the heart center there. Yeah. In the Pandava brothers, which is Krishna, another incarnation of Vishnu, Rama was one and Krishna is the other, it's Bhima. And Bhima is also the son of the wind god. And Hira, and he's the strongest, and Hanuman also very strong. And Bhima is also the strongest man in the kingdom, and so he represents that same heart center there. And of course, with good lungs and good oxygen supply, it brings strength into the body. And so that's also, it's just the physicality of it as well. And being able to have good wind and good strength, and you can tell when somebody has asthma or some other kind of debilitating disease of the lungs there, they don't have vitality, they don't have strength. So they represent that strength of the body, strength of devotion, and strength for aspiration for something higher in life, all three of those. So it's a wonderful, wonderful aspect. These stories, you see, can be heard from so many different viewpoints. Rama and Sita, it's a wonderful love story. It's valorous. They're showing great valor, great strength, great courage. But there's also this underlying meaning to it all, where they have deep metaphysical meanings within all of this. And that's the wonderful aspect of parables, is that there's something for everybody. If somebody's just much more material kind of minded, then there's something there. There's a wonderful story of morality, of courage, of strength, of loyalty. All of those virtues are there. But for the aspirant who's looking for the deeper message, it's also there. And this is true of all the great scriptures all around the world. This is his fundamental statement. He would say, prana is the origin of all power. So prana is life force, it's power within the universe. By practicing prana sadhana, that is directly working, as we do with kriya, with the prana and the breath, all sadhanas can be performed. In other words, the end result of all sadhanas is there. This prana has three states. In the beginning and ending, he is still. In the middle, dynamic. So all prana has those three aspects. In the beginning and end, it's stillness. And in the middle, it's dynamic. Now, this afternoon, as I read that, what I was shown inwardly is that, as we all know, creation has three aspects to it. And in India, there is Brahma, which is the creator. There is Vishnu, which is the preserver. And there is Shiva, which is the destroyer. Within all breath, when a baby comes into the world, of course, it's living by its mother's umbilical cord, and there's no need for breath at that point. But as soon as it's separated from the umbilical cord, the need for breath is immediately there. Before that, there's stillness. There's no breath. And in that stillness is the complete wholeness, a divine spirit. It is the purity of Sat, or that beyond all creation. With the first breath is Brahma, creator of life, brings And with the inhalation comes a pause. Between each breath, there's a pause, both at the inhalation and at the exhalation. And when you're breathing and you're carefully noticing your breath, and as your breath begins to slow down, you'll notice that there's the inhalation, there's a pause, and then there's the exhalation. Pause, inhalation, pause. So the Brahma comes in, and that's the creative force coming into life. Now life is getting anchored into the body with that breath. It's very controversial. When Michelangelo painted the famous painting of God giving life, and he had the finger to Adam, and an electric spark was going between the two. But that's not what it says in the Bible. What it says in the Bible is that God breathed into Adam his life. Now we can understand with the spark, it's like electricity. That's the prana that's going in. But when breath comes into the body, it's with that first breath of the baby. And then, of course, very quickly after that, after the pause, comes what? The scream. Out comes. The pause from the inhalation is the preserver. And that's the preserver. And it takes the breath in. And when the breath comes in, the oxygen is then assimilated into the blood system, which helps to preserve the life into the body. And then, of course, what has to follow after that is the exhalation. With the exhalation are the poisons, is the venous blood that's being emptied, the gases are being emptied out through that blood. So that's Shiva, the destroyer. So you have Brahma through the inhalation, and then Vishnu through the preservation, through the pause in the breath, and then Shiva on the exhalation. And when the breath goes completely out, that's the complete stillness. And of course, when the body is ready to give up, just think of these bellows have been going ever since that you first born. And they're in operation along with the heart and the circulatory system. And if all of that's working all right, you have good health. When your time comes for leaving this body, the breath goes out. And now what? Stillness. You go out of the creation of this body, and it's complete stillness at that point. So at that point then you enter back into that beyond the creation, and every moment that you're breathing, you're starting out with complete stillness. And if you go into a still state, a very still state, you will exhale and there will be no need to inhale. You'll go into a suspended state of animation for some time. The stillness will be so complete, so perfect, and it doesn't harm the brain, it doesn't harm the nervous system. You're just in a complete state of stillness. If you need another breath, you'll take one. But there may be times in deepened meditation where you just suddenly you'll take a breath and you realize, it's been a long time since I breathed last. It's just, it dawns on you that you've been in this state where you've not been breathing. And yet no harm, no problem can accompany other kinds of times when you've not charged the nervous system in the same way. As you have with your kriya and with deepened meditation, you're brought into a state of complete balance, so there's no need for breath in that moment. So in that state, you come into that complete state of stillness. When you breathe in, that's the creator. When you pause, that's the preserver. As you exhale, that's the Shiva, the destroyer. Isn't that wonderful? That's what God showed me this afternoon. I thought that was really good and true. So by practicing prana sadhana, all sadhanas can be performed. This prana has three states. In the beginning and the end, he is still. In the middle, dynamic. Being still in the beginning and end comprises one state. And middle being dynamic is another state. Thus, prana basically has two states. Implies that all elements initially are inexpressible, and then expressible in the middle when they attain shape, and finally after merging, inexpressible again. That happens with every one of your breaths. Dynamic prana is the primordial energy. The vibratory prana is a living being's present existence. So the quality of life that you have is the quality of prana that you have. And as we know, everything in creation has three qualities to it. It's the three gunas. It has the tamasic, the rajasic, and the sattvic. The tamasic is that lethargic, low, tired, don't have it in me, don't want to have it in me, I'm done with this world, I'm sick of it, make it go away somehow. And that's the tamasic. The rajasic, of course, is the activated. And generally it's considered all three are present in us. and they all have a role, but in general it's considered better to be rajasic than tamasic. Rajasic is the act of going. When you sit down to try to meditate and the mind's just bang, 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 synapses are just firing all over the place, your mind's spinning all over, that's rajasic. And that's how many of us live our lives, and that's why it's so difficult to come into a still state. And when we sit down to meditate, what oftentimes happens? We go right past rajasic, right into tamasic. We just want to go to sleep. Because we're not used to going into the sattvic state. Now, if you imagine tamasic and rajasic on a continuum like this, and then see like a pyramid, that sattvic is up here. Sattvic rises above the two polarities of tamasic and rajasic. And the rajasic mind says, well, I'm going to sit there and meditate. I might as well sleep. You know, I might as well not be doing anything. What is this? Because the rajasic mind associates it only with going into tamasic. Dead, nothing there for me, not exciting. Whereas going into the sattvic, you're plugging in to the very source of life. And what I like to tell people is that whatever hobby you have, whatever fantastic interest you have in life, whatever category that is, that's one subcategory that we call God, which is the entire composite of all creation. And that you're plugging into the very source that has created the nebulas, that have created the suns, the stars, the planets, nature that you see around us. Whatever your fascination or interest in life, it's a tiny little subset of the total creativity of God. And so how could you ever think that that would be boring, uninteresting, unintelligent? It's the most fascinating, fantastic adventure that we can go on. But you see how difficult it is to convince the mind of that, because it's so into a pattern that I have, my life is out there, my life is in the world, my life is in this activity. And if I don't have that, then I'm asleep, then I'm dead, then there's nothing. And many people imagine that going into samadhi is going into a state of unconsciousness. And some people, it's very difficult to disabuse them of that. They think they become nothing. And in contrast, they become everything. They think that they go into a state of non-life. And instead, they go in and they plug into the source of all life. But you see what a trick the mind plays on us, that if I'm not this active person in the world, then I'm dead. And we even use language around that. The ego has to die. But what dies is the false notion of separation. It's not the death of you. You are reborn. And that, of course, is the whole point, is to become reborn. The death of individuality and the birth of universality. The birth of everything that is dynamic, everything that is creative, but not in a rajasic, bang, 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 have to kind of way. Very peaceful, very contained. There's a saying in the Hindu scriptures that a medium size or small fish in a small pond will make a big splash. But in the ocean, the whale comes flying up and does a huge splash, but it's a tiny little splash when you compare it with the totality of the ocean. And many of us, the ego minds, are little fish in small ponds. And they think, oh, what a splash I've made. And yogis, in their realization, have tremendous inspiration and realizations, and it leaves not even a ripple. Because the ocean of their consciousness, Mahasya in Lahari Mahasya, Mahasya means large-minded, means universally-minded. It means vast-minded, vast consciousness. And that tremendous realization can come, and just not even hardly a ripple, just an acknowledgement, a recognition. So these are tremendous states of being that these great masters come to. So dynamic prana is the middle, when they attain shape and finally, after merging, becomes inexpressible again. Dynamic prana is the primordial energy. The vibratory prana is a living being's presence existence. The entire universe has manifested itself from this dynamic prana. All actions emanate from this vibratory prana. But still, prana is the place of origin for the dynamic prana. Neither does passive prana perform anything, nor does he actuate any action. He is a constant spectator only. Now, what this means is that in your existence, you have two different aspects. Because you are all of these things that's being described here. So, when you are active in this world, that is the active prana, the active life moving through you. And you sense it. You feel it. You know that this life force is moving through you. It's speaking through you. It's thinking through you. It's acting through you. And yet there's a part of you that stands aside. If you've developed this through practice, you are the observer. You are the witness. You're the witness to whatever the act of prana is doing through you. Most of us think that we are the actor. I'm the life. I'm the life force. I'm the intelligence. I've identified with myself with those different roles that I play in there, and that's the beginning of delusion. That makes me identified with a very small element of myself. When I can stand apart from that and be a witness to that, be an observer to it, now I can witness this life force acting through me, speaking through me, thinking through me, and I'm watching it all. I'm seeing it all. So there's a part of me that is sensing this flow, knowing that it's moving through me, but there's another part of me who's witnessing, who's observing. Krishna makes the point again and again. The problem is you think that you are the doer. And that gets us caught up. It gets us excited about life. Look at what I can do. But it also makes us totally responsible for the outcomes of things. And then that makes us either on a high because things are going well, or on a low because things are going, from a human perspective, lousy. And we are on these constant ups and downs, ups and downs. To stand aside and have the viewpoint as if you are standing on the banks of a river and watching the river go by, watching the river go by. Sometimes it's huge rapids just ramping itself through. Other times, it's very cool, calm, placid, and everything in between. And as you're an observer of your life, you become freed of the cause and effect. You become freed of your attachment to the outcomes. Now, the human ego will say, but I'll be irresponsible, or everything will fall apart. If I don't do it, it won't get done. Your sole responsibility is attunement to that prana flowing through you. And it will act through you. It will think through you if you will allow it, if you don't get in its way. And if you can imagine the first time perhaps that you went bowling, and maybe you were one of those lucky ones and you got a nice spare or you got a nice strike or something, and you thought, oh, then you get really excited. Then you really try to control that ball, and right into the gutter it goes every single time. The more you try to control it, the worse you get. Or if you've ever played golf, you know, and you get a nice hit right down the fairway and go, man, I got it. I know what I'm doing now. And the more you try to control it, the worse you get. You're getting in the way of that flow of prana. Whereas you have no expectation, you can stand aside and it will actually hit the ball through you or bowl the ball through you. And so if you can practice that with everything that you do, it operates through you but not from you. Just like your children come through you, not from you. Life force comes through you, not from you. And when we identify with ourselves as the doer, it depletes us. At the end of the day, we feel worn out, we feel beat up because we feel like we've been the doer all through the day. When you're the observer and attuning yourself to the life force that's flowing through you, having trust in it, it's not being irresponsible. It takes more responsibility, but your responsibility is not for the outcomes. It's for the attunement to the highest vibrational rate of life force that's available to you in the moment. And you surrender to it. You allow it to guide you. You allow it to move through you, even when it seems inexplicable to you on an individual basis. So sometimes people will call me. Somebody called me the other day and they asked me to call them back. And I went to pick up the phone to call them back. No, don't call them back. So I waited, and a few days later I got a call back from them. And they've been a little upset because I hadn't called them back, but also during that time they decided to take some action on their own around it. And they were in a difficulty, they were in a problematic relationship. They took that action and everything had worked out perfectly. So, and of course, they're the better because they took that responsibility. They worked to attune themselves in that way. So this higher intelligence, this higher prana, is connected with all the intelligence and all the life energy throughout the universe. So when you make it your intention, I want this to be for the highest good of everybody concerned. And that's your intention. And then you attune yourself to the prana or the life energy that will respond in this world for the highest good of everybody concerned. And then you surrender to that. You attune yourself to it. When it comes to you, you attune yourself to it. And you guide your life according to that. And in a way that your own intelligence, your own personal intelligence, couldn't possibly anticipate. All the ins and outs, as you surrender and follow according to that inner dictate, it is for the highest good of everybody concerned. So it's a wonderful, wonderful way to attune yourself. And this is all prana sadhana. Prana sadhana. It's attuning yourself to this prana, to this intelligent life energy. Your sadhana is your spiritual practice. Your spiritual practice is that inward attunement. First of all, learning how to direct the life force up through the spine to the higher centers and attuning yourself in that way, and then seeing this creative act as Brahma coming down through the spine and then expressing itself out through your body, through your brain, through your spine, through your heart, through your entire body. And what bliss comes to you through this attunement? What peace comes to you through this attunement? A peace and a bliss and a joy that the world cannot match. And a wisdom of action that the mind could never even come close to. And so this prana sadhana, and getting very familiar with your own prana, going deeper into the mysteries of how this prana works in you, learning how that you don't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. What a wonderful, wonderful teaching that is. And if we can really delve into it more deeply, realize it in our beings, what a wonderful potentiality this begins to represent. We hear these stories of these great masters who have these tremendous powers and are able to do tremendous things. And they are wonderful. They are tremendous. But really, when we look at it, it's not the supernatural in that kind of sense that's really at the most basic core of experience that we're looking for. To be able to enter into that stillness that's being talked about here, that complete stillness, when the breath goes out completely and you are in that complete state of stillness, and then to have that creative act come in through your breath, the preservative and the destructive, expelling out the poison gases, and going deeper and deeper into that until you just go into that complete still state. That is what is really magnificent. and takes you into the truth of your own being. And truthfully, there can be saints and people of high realization who can do really what we would call miraculous things and are not fully realized. And so, as Sri Yukteswar says, you could have control over the entire universe and still not have God. Now, to the material mind, that seems incomprehensible because we associate power with realization. But real power is the ability to enter into the still state. As David said in the Psalms, "Be still and know that I am God."
And that's not realization.
That is realization. Powers are not a sign, an absolute sign of realization. Being able to enter into stillness and the ever new joy that comes from that, that is realization.
Sai Baba keeps popping into my head.
Somebody who exhibits tremendous powers, but doesn't necessarily have the whole package. And I think he's tremendous.
But he doesn't,
as Papa says, until you have complete realization, you can do no good.
Oh, yeah.
Because it always gets tainted with something of the ego. And Satya Sai Baba has had some problems along the way. And it taints the work that he does. So it will always come out. It will always come out when there's something there that will trip up somebody along the way. So when they're trying to do good, but then it gets what you might say polluted with something of the ego, then that really hurts any of the kind of good that they've done. So of course we have to act. So we serve. We serve the best that we know how to. We act in the best way that we know how to, knowing that we're going to make mistakes along the way. It doesn't mean that we don't act, but that you can only do predictable good, complete good, only when you have complete realization.